Let me preface by saying the obvious. The views I express today are, of course, my own and not those of my firm or any of our clients. Having said that, since we're here to talk about hedge funds, I thought it might first make sense to talk about what is a hedge fund. There's no universally accepted definition. What the SEC said in 2003 in their report on the implications of the growth of hedge funds was that the term generally is used to refer to an entity that holds a pool of securities and perhaps other assets whose interests are not sold in a registered public offering and which is not registered as an investment company under the Investment Company Act. So, according to the SEC report, the critical elements seem to be a legal entity that invests in securities and maybe other stuff, interests in which are sold to investors in an offering not registered under the Securities Act of 1933, and the entity itself not being registered under the Investment Company Act of 1940. I think that's a fine start. There are some other characteristics I think I'd keep in mind as we go through today's presentations. Typically, but not always, there are multiple investors in a hedge fund. The basic setup is that the fund is formed so that a professional investment manager can manage the money of the investors. It's the professional investment manager, not the investors, who are making the investment decisions. The investment program, as a corollary to that, is conducted with respect to the goals of the vehicle as a whole and not with respect to the goals of any single investor in the fund. Investors have limited or no control rights. Interests in the vehicles are not exchange-traded or freely transferable, really. The industry standard is you need the general partner's or the investment manager's consent to transfer, and that can be withheld in the GP's or the investment manager's sole discretion. But you can achieve liquidity in your hedge fund interest, and the typical way of doing that is by submitting a redemption request, which is a request that the fund give you some or all of your money back at the current net asset value per share. And net asset value, it just means what your share is worth if you take all the assets of the fund, subtract all the liabilities, and divide it by the number of shares outstanding. Lastly, the vehicles tend to be open-ended, meaning that you can not only redeem from them, but they tend to offer continuous subscriptions, and they tend to be perpetual in life. One thing I think is sometimes useful to think about in thinking about hedge funds is how they're different from mutual funds, since everyone's generally familiar with mutual funds. They're very similar in that, you know, both are legal entities. There's a professional investment manager for both. The investors have very limited rights in terms of control. They offer liquidity to investors via redemptions rather than on an exchange or rather than secondary market transfers. And they both are open-ended in terms of continuous subscriptions and redemptions and having a perpetual life. I think the primary differences for purposes of our talk today are that mutual funds are registered under the Investment Company Act by definition, and they tend to be offered in public offerings that are registered under the Securities Act of 1933. As a result of those two things, mutual funds are broadly available. They can have commercials on TV with Paul McCartney in them, and you can have them in your 401k, and everyone knows what they are. In terms of regulation, I think I want to start by saying my premise today, or my theme on this part of the talk, is that what we hear in the press about hedge funds being lightly regulated or unregulated is a little bit of a canard. They are, in fact, heavily regulated. It is true that they're regulated differently and perhaps slightly less extensively than mutual funds, but nonetheless heavily regulated. And so I want to go through a little bit of that regulation today. The four primary laws that I think we ought to talk about in that regard is the Investment Company Act of 1940, the Investment Advisors Act of 1940, the Securities Act of 1933, and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. Well, I'm going to talk about those things briefly, just to give you a sense of how regulated hedge funds are. Let me say at this point that I'm not going to be covering the manner in which hedge funds and their managers are regulated under state securities laws, state and federal tax laws, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, the Commodity Exchange Act, non-U.S. laws, banking laws, other than Dodd-Frank and Volcker, about which more in a moment. insurance law, antitrust law, self-regulatory bodies such as the exchanges and FINRA, energy regulation, beneficial ownership reporting, or accounting rules, all of which can and do affect hedge funds and their managers, but we don't have time for today. So let me start with the Investment Company Act of 1940, probably the most important law to think about in thinking about investment funds in the U.S., commonly referred to as the 40 Act or the Company Act or the ICA. The 40 Act, the first thing to understand about it is that it provides for substantive regulation of investment companies, not just mandatory disclosure like the Securities Act of 1933, but actual substantive limitations on what the funds can do. These take the form of leverage limits, limits on affiliate transactions, required shareholder reports, required portfolio reports, and board independence requirements, among other things. Hedge funds avoid registration under the 40 Act by means of taking advantage of an exemption. And remember, this is under the SEC's definition, one of the key criteria of hedge funds, that they're not registered under the 40 Act. There's two exemptions that pretty much all hedge funds make use of. One is Section 3C1 of the 40 Act, and one is Section 3C7. 3C1 is very easy. If you have fewer than 100 holders, you're eligible. It's less popular than 3C7 because it does limit the size of the fund, but it has no minimum investor sophistication or net worth standard, and it's pretty easy to comply with. One of the criteria, though, is no public offering is permitted. The other primary exemption is 3C7, which permits an unlimited number of holders, so long as everyone is a qualified purchaser. Because this is an exemption without a size limit, it's much more popular, much more taken advantage of by hedge funds. The qualified purchaser test is a wealth standard. It measures your quote-unquote investments as defined, and you need to have $5 million if you're an individual, $25 million if you're an entity. There are other exemptions out there. These are by far the most commonly used. And I would point out that while we're taking advantage of exemptions here for hedge funds, complying with the exemptions themselves is a form of regulation with which the funds must comply. The theory behind these two exemptions is one that, you know, regulation is not necessarily desirable where you have a small number of people. That's the 3C1 theory. The 3C7 theory is regulation may not be necessary where you have very sophisticated, wealthy people. Now, you can question both of those. If Bernie Madoff ripped off only a few people, would he be any less Bernie Madoff? And is wealth a good proxy for solicitation? You know, there are wealthy people who, you know, may not be sophisticated investors. The next law to think about is the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. And whereas the Company Act really would require registration of the fund as an investment vehicle, the Advisors Act focuses on regulation of the manager, the investment manager as the person responsible for making all the fund's investments. It includes both disclosure elements and substantive regulation. In terms of disclosure, it requires the manager to file Form ADV, Part 1, deliver a Part 2 of Form ADV to investors. And there's a bunch of very specific requirements in terms of what must be disclosed to your investors under those forms. The Advisors Act also creates an interesting federal fiduciary duty, which has disclosure implications, but also substantive implications in terms of the investment advisor's duty to its clients, which include the hedge fund. Other substantive things that come with the Advisors Act are restrictions on causing trades between the advisor and its client, so-called principal transactions, restrictions on the advisor causing trades between two clients, so-called cross transactions, restrictions on permissible types of fees, restrictions on marketing, record-keeping requirements, required policies and procedures, and lastly, that the advisor be subject to SEC examination. Generally speaking, an advisor is required to register if they're advising others on investing in securities for compensation, and that is the business they're in. There are hedge fund managers who are not registered with the SEC under various exemptions. Most large hedge fund managers are registered, and the Dodd-Frank Act has made that more the case. It's eliminated the fewer than 15 client exemption, which lots of hedge fund managers relied on, including some very large ones. And the rule was, if you have fewer than 15 clients, and for this purpose we're going to count a single hedge fund as a single client, then you need not register. So I could manage, in theory, $100 billion worth of assets, but if they're held in two hedge funds, then I have only two clients and didn't need to register. That's changing under Dodd-Frank. Next, I think, let's talk for just a second about the Securities Act of 1933. This, again, was one of the criteria the SEC mentioned in its definition of hedge funds, that their offerings are not registered under the 33 Act. The 33 Act, unlike the Company Act or the Advisors Act, is really just a disclosure law. There's no substantive regulation of the securities offered. In other words, the SEC doesn't look at a security and say that this is junk or this is good. The SEC is agnostic. Their view is towards disclosure. So hedge funds sell in unregistered offerings. Typically, domestically, this is going to be via private placements, and offshore via what's something called Regulation S. The domestic private placements, there's a section of the Securities Act you can rely on, Section 4.2, and you can do what's called a common law private placement. But since the adoption of Regulation D, which is a private placement safe harbor, pretty much everybody relies on Regulation D. The trouble with the common law 4.2 exemption is that, you know, it's defined by the courts. Some of you may have read Ralston Purina or other relevant cases in your securities regulation class. And it's not crystal clear always whether you have a good private placement. So people like to rely on the safe harbor. There are three safe harbors under Reg D. There's Rule 504, which is an exemption for offerings of $1 million or less. Rule 505, an exemption for offerings of $5 million or less. And Rule 506, which is an exemption for offerings of unlimited size. Who wants to take a guess at what hedge funds rely on? Yeah. They rely on Rule 506, which has a few requirements. One is no general advertising, general solicitation. You can't be selling this stuff on the television like Fidelity. You can't go speak publicly about it. You can't go into the press. You can't use the internet. The SEC has further said that you can only sell to people with whom you have a substantive pre-existing relationship, which is essentially a business-type relationship that pre-exists by at least 30 days your sale of a hedge fund interest to that investor. There's a standard under Rule 506 that permits you to solicit and sell to an unlimited number of accredited investors. And up to 35 non-accrediteds. The accredited investor test is less than the qualified purchaser test I mentioned a minute ago, so it's generally, if you're going to fit that one, this one's a slam dunk. It's $1 million in net worth, not counting your home for individuals, or $200,000 in income in the last 2 years, or $300,000 with your spouse, and an expectation of making the same this year. For entities, it's $5 million. You can permit up to 35 non-accredited investors in a Rule 506 offering. People generally don't do it because there are some significant disclosure requirements that are actually very difficult for ongoing hedge funds to meet. And just, again, I want to make the point that these are all rules that hedge funds are subject to. So, again, although we're hitting an exemption from 33 Act registration, very much it's the offer and sale of hedge fund interest is a regulated activity here. Lastly, in terms of regulation, let me mention the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, the 34 Act, or the Exchange Act, it's commonly called. This act is designed to govern secondary markets and securities primarily. It governs securities brokers, dealers, securities exchanges, other securities trading venues, and the secondary markets generally. There are a number of concerns under the 34 Act for hedge funds, but three principal ones are anti-fraud, sales activities / broker-dealer regulation, and Section 12G. Anti-fraud is pretty straightforward. We have Rule 10b-5, Section 10b of the Act. Typically, this is addressed by hedge funds in what's called a private placement memorandum or an offering memorandum. It's a disclosure document. I've seen them as short as 25 pages and as long as over 200 pages. The idea is that the document gives you the basic fund terms, in terms of structure, fees, expenses, the investment objective and program, investment restrictions, and redemption terms. There is also a lot of disclosure about risk factors and conflicts of interest disclosure. One interesting thing about private placement memoranda is every time there's a big hedge fund crisis, they get fatter. So after long-term capital management blew up in 1998, private placement memorandums got a lot thicker. After Amaranth blew up, a little bit thicker still. And after 2008, a little bit thicker still. They'll also include tax disclosure and some other items. Next under the 34 Act is sales activities / broker-dealer regulation. Under Section 15 of the 34 Act, you're not allowed to engage in the business of offering and selling securities unless you're registered as a broker-dealer. Hedge funds tend to use either in-house registered broker-dealers, a registered affiliate, or third-party distribution arrangements, third-party placement agents, or sometimes rely on an exemption called 3A41. But the point is that the offers and sales are regulated. And lastly, Section 12G of the 34 Act provides what people refer to commonly as the 500 holder limit. And what 12G says is that if you have an entity that has 500 or more holders of record and more than 10 million in assets, you've got to register on 12G, and then you've got to start preparing and filing 34 Act reports, which include 10Ks and 10Qs and the like. So it's critical for hedge funds that they avoid that. I'm about up in terms of time, but let me just mention a couple developments and trends. And I think the major trend that we're seeing lately is a focus on systemic risk and the effects and the interaction of hedge funds with the larger financial ecosystem. So although there are, kind of business-friendly types in favor of less regulation and consumer and public-minded people in favor of more regulation in terms of protecting investors, everyone seems to agree that one thing that needs to be controlled is the ability of hedge funds to mess up the general economy. So examples of this trend in legislation and regulation include the Volcker Rule, which limits banks' investments in hedge funds and support of hedge funds in different ways. Banks can't invest more than 3% in any given hedge fund. There's an upper ceiling of 3% of a bank's Tier 1 capital that it can invest in all kind of private equity funds or hedge funds. And Tier 1 capital is just a bank capital measure. It's its most stable tranche of capital in its capital structure. There are limits on ability of bank employees to invest in hedge funds. There are limits on transactions between banks and hedge funds and private equity funds. And again, those limits are to protect the bank, not to protect the investors. They are to protect the bank from engaging in dealings with the hedge fund that are giving the hedge fund better than arm's length terms. There's swaps clearing regulation now, which requires that swaps generally be cleared through clearing houses, which is supposed to provide some measure of stability to that market. SEC is monitoring hedge fund holdings through forms PF and 13H, and the CFTC is expanding its application of speculative position limits, again, in an effort to keep speculation in the commodities markets down. So while the individual investor has not been forgotten and regulation is still designed to protect individual investors, the current trend clearly is to also factor into hedge fund regulation and in financial market regulation generally an element of protecting the markets from individual actors and hedge funds in particular. Thanks.
Is that on? Okay. David already covered the basics of what a hedge fund is, but let me kind of, and also he did a great job of covering a lot of the specifics of their regulation. I want to back up and kind of draw some general category lines in terms of types of regulation and purposes of regulation that apply to hedge funds. I want to begin by talking, as David did, a little bit about what precisely a hedge fund is. As David mentioned, it's kind of unclear. There's a lot of disagreement about what precisely a hedge fund is. Let's just go to slideshow. There we go. there's a lot of disagreement about what precisely a hedge fund is. Everyone seems to agree, as David pointed out, that it's an entity that doesn't report under the Investment Company of under the Investment Company Act of 1940. And everyone also seems to agree that it's an entity that holds a lot of securities. The problem is that holding a lot of securities is not really a sufficient criterion for defining hedge funds, because lots of companies hold lots of securities. For example, General Electric and PepsiCo consist mostly of securities. They don't own factories. They own stock in subsidiaries which own factories. And so the mere fact of securities ownership is, in my opinion at least, not really sufficient to define hedge funds, or any type of investment fund for that matter. So as David did, I want to add a couple of extra criteria. One is that a hedge fund separates investments and management into distinct entities. In a typical hedge fund, there will be a fund that holds all of the investment assets, and then a management company that employs all of the workers and signs the office leases and holds all of the operational assets. All investment funds do this. And lastly, hedge funds offer redemption rights, as David pointed out. I'm going to cover these last two bullet points in a little more detail because they turn out to be important for determining what sorts of regulation are helpful and necessary in hedge funds. There are three categories of issues that I'm going to cover, and they each arise from different roles that hedge funds play, and they each pose different problems for regulation. The first is that hedge funds are issuers of securities, that is, they sell stock and other securities to investors. They are investors in securities, they buy stock and other types of securities from other companies. And lastly, they're actors in the financial system. Let's start by thinking about hedge funds' role as issuers of securities, that is, how they relate to their own investors. Now, what makes hedge funds unique, as I pointed out earlier in this regard, is partly that they offer redemption rights. This makes hedge funds very different from ordinary companies. In an ordinary company, if you want to exit your investment, you have to sell your shares. So we have here this basic example. Let's imagine an operating company with $10,000 in net assets, and let's imagine a shareholder who owns shares in that company. That shareholder will own shares reflecting a certain claim, say an equity interest, on assets that underlie the shares. When the shareholder wants to get rid of his position in the company, he can sell it to another shareholder. Note, though, that when he does so, the assets remain locked inside the company. If I sell my shares to you, the ownership of the underlying assets has not changed, only the ownership of the stock has changed. By contrast, in a hedge fund, exit occurs by redemption. So let's imagine here a hedge fund with $10,000 in net assets and a shareholder who owns equity interests representing claims on $1,000 of those assets. When the shareholder redeems, the shareholder will hand over his or her shares to the fund, and the fund will, in return, hand over the proportion of the fund of the fund's net assets that corresponds to those shares. So in this example, the shareholder owns shares representing $1,000. When the shareholder redeems, the hedge fund pays out $1,000 to the shareholder. The hedge fund correspondingly declines in size, and the shares no longer exist. In other words, the relationship between the shareholder and the fund has ceased to exist, and the fund no longer controls the assets. Now, this has profound consequences for the control structure of hedge funds. In an ordinary company, if I don't like what the company is doing with my assets, it's no remedy to sell my shares, because the person who buys the shares from me is stuck in the same position. The bad management will still control the assets. As a consequence, sometimes shareholders in ordinary companies will actually vote to change the managers of the companies. By contrast, in a hedge fund, if I don't like what the managers are doing with my money, I'm not going to waste time voting. I'm just going to take my ball and go home. I'm just going to get my assets out and invest them in some other company. So to put it very simply, redemption rights make hedge funds look a lot like products. Let's say, for example, I don't like Pepsi. I don't like the flavor. I don't like the price. I'm not going to waste time voting to change the flavor or price of Pepsi. I'm just going to buy Coke. Likewise, if I don't like the way James Simon, you can tell that he's a hedge fund manager because he looks very rich. If I don't like the way one rich guy is managing my money, I'll just hire another rich guy to manage my money. So this has, like I said, profound consequences for control structures in hedge funds. As David pointed out, investors in hedge funds do not have meaningful control rights. if the investors of a hedge fund say to a manager, invest in this, and the manager says, no, I'm going to invest in that, the manager wins. There's no breach of contract there. Additionally, hedge funds separate investments and management. So let's just imagine a typical hedge fund complex here. We'll say it's D.E. Shaw, which is a large hedge fund management company. D.E. Shaw is a private company with its own set of owners. Now let's imagine that D.E. Shaw sets up a bunch of funds. We'll say hedge funds A, B, and C, and also a private equity fund for good measure. D.E. Shaw will cause each of those funds to sign a management contract, which, as I said earlier, will give D.E. Shaw almost total authority about how to invest those funds' assets. And then at some point in this process, each of those funds will go out and seek investment from other investors. Now, this setup seems sensible enough, but imagine how kooky it would be in an ordinary company. Imagine if instead of hedge fund A, we put Microsoft up there. Imagine how bizarre it would be if Microsoft had no employees and instead received all of its management and decision-making from an outside company, which in turn managed many other companies, some of which might compete directly with Microsoft, such as Apple Computer, for example. That would be bizarre in an ordinary company, but it occurs in virtually all types of investment funds in one fashion or another. Now, the primary problem that this creates is it means that hedge fund managers are deeply conflicted. D.E. Shaw owes loyalties not just to the shareholders in hedge fund A, but also to the owners of D.E. Shaw, and also to the owners of each of these other three funds. So if D.E. Shaw is presented with a particularly good investment opportunity, which fund gets it? Right? It's a profound conflict. But once again, the product analogy is apt. D.E. Shaw is like PepsiCo. PepsiCo operates all of the different product lines you see here, and it also faces conflicts of interest among the product lines. If PepsiCo gets particularly good or particularly low-priced corn, which of these products is going to get it? The customers of each product line could benefit, but they can't all simultaneously get it. And so PepsiCo makes an arbitrary decision. Now, the reason this works in both product manufacturers and in hedge fund managers is that if I don't like Pepsi, I'll just buy Coke. Right, if I don't like the way PepsiCo is resolving conflicts, I'll just move to another supplier. Same thing with a hedge fund. If I don't like the way D.E. Shaw is managing my money, I'll invest with someone else. So the first category of issue was hedge funds' role as issuers of securities. Now let's think about their role as investors in securities. There aren't really special regulations that apply to hedge funds as investors in securities. Really, the same sorts of laws that apply to other investors in securities also apply to hedge funds. By contrast, there are special laws that deal with hedge funds' role as issuers of securities, and those would be, for example, the Investment Advisors Act. At least that's how I would characterize it. Maybe David would disagree. The last category of issues deals with hedge funds' role as actors in the financial system. As David pointed out, hedge funds are often very highly leveraged. Their leverage can come from a variety of sources. It might be direct borrowing. It might be derivatives contracts entered into with other financial institutions. Here, the argument is really about a kind of externality. The notion is that when a hedge fund collapses, it can do damage to the entire financial system. And so the hedge fund managers and their investors don't internalize all of the costs of that damage. It's like PepsiCo dumping corn syrup into rivers instead of into people's bodies. Right, the damage done by dumping corn syrup into people's bodies is internalized, quite literally, by the people who drink Pepsi, whereas the damage done by dumping corn syrup into rivers is not. Likewise, in a hedge fund, if I collapse and send shrapnel flying throughout the financial system, I do damage that I'm not really paying for. And so Dodd-Frank is taking the first halting steps toward regulating hedge funds' activities in this regard. So I'll end there, and we can talk more about the specifics of each of these categories of regulation.
I think the redemption issue that John raised is particularly interesting to look at. Some of you may have noticed an article today in the Wall Street Journal dealing with this exact topic, and it can sometimes lead to some pretty high drama, right? Hedge funds have not done terribly well this year, like with a lot of other types of investments. And many hedge fund investors have between 45 and 60 days prior to the end of the year to tell their managers whether they want to redeem their funds. Well, if you look at the calendar, right, that's kind of the next week or so. So a lot of hedge fund, you know, operators are basically waiting and waiting and waiting, kind of wringing their hands to see, in the face of pretty poor performance, whether there's going to be a massive run to redeem, which is essentially, as John showed you, going to shrink down their base of operations. So that there's kind of a lot of drama to look at in the next, you know, next week or two on this. Okay, in any event, both of you hinted at this, but I want to ask you to talk, to comment, if you can, a little more specifically on what you see Dodd-Frank doing, if anything, on the regulation of hedge fund activity. Certainly, from a broad theoretical point of view, there are a number of issues that it's trying to get at. As you kind of watch and observe the implementation of Dodd-Frank, do you think that when it's finally, you know, the smoke finally clears, there's going to be a relatively big impact on the regulation of hedge funds, or do you think that it's not going to have that much of a fundamental change on what's going on here? David, maybe I can ask you to start and then come over to John.
Sure. I think that a good amount of the Dodd-Frank impact will be on the trading market, so the swaps clearing that I mentioned, and trying to bring stability to the markets in terms of hedge fund as traders in the markets. In terms of regulating hedge funds themselves, as I mentioned, there are some changes in who must register as an investment advisor federally and who's permitted to register as an investment advisor federally. I think you're going to see a lot more investment advisors have to register, some with the states, some federally. But from my perspective, and this may partly be a function of my client base, but one of the largest things to notice about Dodd-Frank is the Volcker Rule and its restrictions on bank proprietary trading, bank investments in hedge funds and private equity funds, and bank support of and involvement in transactions with hedge funds and private equity funds.
I think that there's going to be more and more, I agree with David, more hedge fund advisors are going to be registering under the Investment Advisors Act. I don't see this as a crippling sort of piece of regulation for advisors. And the reason is that the restrictions imposed by the Advisors Act are fairly light in terms of substantive limits. I think the main product is just to increase the amount of reporting and compliance burden on funds from the Advisors Act. Another potential source of limits on hedge funds will be the Financial Stability Oversight Council. So there's this new council of regulators that's supposed to regulate any large financial institution that is highly leveraged and deeply interconnected in the financial system. It remains to be seen who precisely is going to become subject to oversight by the Financial Stability Oversight Council. There's been some regulations that were just recently proposed that would define who is going to be subject to oversight by this council. It would probably include most hedge funds. But the real game, once we decide who's going to be subject to oversight, is what precisely that oversight will mean. And as yet, I don't think there's any clarity on that.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I agree also in terms of the effect of registration under the Advisors Act. I don't think that's a game changer so much for hedge fund managers.
Can you tell me, David, why is it that hedge fund managers resisted so strongly the requirement to register? I mean, the perception in the academic community anyway is that this is just not a terribly big deal.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much truth there is to that, honestly. The hedge fund advisor registration rule of 5 years ago that was then struck down by the D.C. Circuit was a change in the way the industry was looked at and managed, but from my perspective, I think most large hedge funds and the banks and financial institutions that engage in hedge fund type activities were already registered. I think for the smaller shops, you know, if you're under 200 million or certainly, you know, 100 million, it can be more expensive to comply with those sorts of things. But I think the bigger shops have always just considered a cost of business.
One thought that makes me have is that one of the amendments in Dodd-Frank is that investment advisors with less than $100 million under management cannot register, even if they want to. The advantage of registering with the federal government is that you get to be exempted from state regulation. And so Congress made the judgment in the Dodd-Frank Act that it doesn't want advisors with less than $100 million under management to be registered with the SEC because that increases the SEC's regulatory burden. The SEC has to conduct investigations or examinations of each of these advisors. So maybe one effect of the new registration requirements will be to drive out small shops. If you're less than $100 million, you have to bear the cost of registering in every state where you want to sell securities.
But that could be a consequence. It certainly is requiring a number of managers to deregister federally, which is not a good thing from their perspective. They may have to register with six different states as a result.
I've got some other questions on regulation, but I actually want to jump ahead a little bit and switch gears. Many of you may be in this room, not only because of the Free Chipotle, but also because you're interested in doing something in the area of hedge fund work when you go off and become a lawyer. And I want to ask both of our panelists to comment a little bit on what's it like to actually be doing work in this area? I mean, what are the things you're doing on a day-to-day basis as a lawyer that's working in the hedge fund industry? Again, David, maybe I can start with you.
Great. At the moment, it's a lot of catch-up. The rules are just being written faster than people can read them, honestly. So for the last 2 years, really, people have been worrying about Dodd-Frank and worrying about the Volcker Rule and all the rulemakings under Dodd-Frank. And now that those are coming out and being proposed and finalized, people are spending tons of time reading them, understanding them, writing comment letters, and advising clients on them. From the client's perspective, it's not the best use of their legal budget. This is just pure compliance. This is not an investment in creating a new product or something that will make them money. This is strictly a cost of doing business. So that's one element of hedge fund attorney life these days, is just dealing with this barrage of new law. In terms of the more common aspect, when markets are normal, a hedge fund attorney's practice is transactional in nature. It involves a lot of drafting, a lot of counseling, and ongoing compliance work.
Do you see differences in working in the area of fund formation versus working with more ongoing and established funds from a legal advisory point of view?
No, I think the issues are the same when you're setting up a fund and then when you're advising on its ongoing operations. I think there's more work at the outset to set up the fund, but the issues then are the exact same issues involved in running a fund. So you kind of tend to do them all together.
Mm-hmm. Anything, John, you want to add on the practice of lawyers in this area?
I just want to say that one time as an associated law firm, we represented a hedge fund manager, and my assignment was to try to predict the outcome of a case before lunchtime so that the manager could buy stock in the winning party. Sometimes you do that kind of thing. I also one time was asked if you could take a security interest in an appraisal right in a merger. The hedge fund was a shareholder in a Target. And as hedge funds will, they wanted to borrow on everything they possibly could. And so they wanted to know whether they could borrow on their appraisal, right? So every now and again, you'll get asked to advise hedge funds in their role as investors. I think what David was talking about was hedge funds' role as issuers of securities, but occasionally also you can work on their role as investors.